Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take up the topic of how smart is your dog and dog intelligence. And we have a couple of guests for you today. And we're talking about the book Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence, a wonderful book. And the author with us today, with me in the studio, Jennifer Holland. She is the author of some books you may have, other books you may have read. One titled Unlikely Friendships was a New York Times bestseller for 40-some weeks at least. She has three more best-selling books in the Unlikely Friendships series. She's also a contributor to New York Times, Washington Post, and NPR, and a whole bunch of other things. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
With us as well, my old pal, Patricia McConnell.
Well, hey, Larry Mueller. Good to see you.
Patricia and I did a show together called Calling All Pets for a long time, and she, of course, is a certified applied animal behavior. She's an international speaker, traveler, author of several books, and on dogs and people and dog behavior, and I think my favorite might be The Other End of the Leash.
Yes.
That was probably my favorite of your books, Patricia. It's great to have you here. And your comments appear, to some extent, in Jennifer's book.
She was a wonderful resource. Yeah. One of my heroes, definitely. And I was really excited to have her as part of the book.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what. If you, as you listen in today, if you have a dog, or maybe if you have a friend who has a dog, how do you recognize their personality or their intelligence? How does your dog show off its intelligence? That'd be a good one to talk about. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jennifer, in your book this time, I love the book, by the way.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed reading it. Maybe a little different, I think, from some of the other books, because this time you've incorporated a lot of, I would call it cutting-edge science. But it's also chock full of great stories, things that you've done and what other people have done. So it's a wonderful combination of the two. But you wanted to lean into the science this time a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted it to be very approachable science. I didn't want to scare people away with the idea that it's a science-y book. But I felt like with the stories and the field work and kind of getting out there and experiencing it with the dogs and telling those stories, you can really access and understand the science very easily.
Yeah, it was amazing. Patricia, it's important to know, for us to know more about how our dogs think, isn't it?
Oh, so in so many ways. But first, I just want to circle back a tiny bit. I, too, love this book. I have raved about this book. It is the perfect combination to me of science and soul. You know, the science is fascinating. It's beautifully presented. And the thing about Jennifer is she's one of these people. I've compared her to Cy Montgomery, who is another one of my heroes. So I have a new hero, which is Jennifer. She's just one of those people. She wants to learn about something, so she goes swims with sharks. And she's, she's up in the treetops in Costa Rica. I mean, she's fearless. She's curious. And she presents really fascinating science because canine cognition is so hot right now.
It is.
And this book is such a great compilation of sort of what's going on. And you can't read it without looking at your dog and thinking like, wow, what's going on in there that I'm just starting to learn about?
Yeah. And when we think about, why do we need to reframe, though, our idea of what intelligence means with dogs?
My thought was that, it's clearly intelligence when you have a dog that learns quickly, that learns your commands, that, sort of does all the things that we want our dogs to do. But dogs are their own thing, and we forget that they're not little people, that they are an entirely different species, that they experience the world differently, their sensory experience is different, and what's germane to them can be different. And it just occurred to me that there's things about dogs that take intelligence that we might not normally think of in that definition. So why not take the tools that they have naturally, their olfaction, their amazing communication, their emotional intelligence, and think about, you know, what does that mean in the dog's world? How does that manifest itself? And just think about it sort of through the dog's eyes, through their nose. What does it mean to be smart?
What does it mean? Yeah. What's the difference between instinct and intelligence?
I think of it as, you know, instinct is sort of, it's in there. You know, it's kind of this automatic response. And I think for a long time, people thought of other animals as really just instinct machines, that they really didn't have intelligence and emotion and kind of these other ideas that we think of in humans. Whereas intelligence, you can grow it, you can evolve, you can change, you can, excuse me, you can, you know, how you live your life changes, you know, what you're intelligent about and how that shows. And so I think they are very different concepts.
Yeah, I think they are too. And you write that dogs have superpowers.
Right.
That we can't fully comprehend. And you were kind of getting at that a little bit, but talk some more about that.
Yeah, I think olfactory intelligence, as I call it in the book, I think was the main superpower, just because that is their tool of choice. It is the tool that they use, you know, the most in terms of how they experience the world, how they make decisions and choices. And so I see it as a superpower because it's just such a powerful component of who they are as creatures and how they navigate. But, you know, they do have, I think, various superpowers, but I would say in the book that's the primary one that I focus on.
A whole lot better than ours.
Absolutely. Ours is pretty good for what we need it for, but for dogs it's just a different world.
Yeah.
And, you know, ours is actually a little better than we tend to think because we're not that conscious of it. But I want to mention how important this point about canine cognition is that Jennifer makes so well in the book. As a trainer and behaviorist, what I've seen, and we've all seen it over and over and over again, a dog doesn't do what somebody wants, and they say, stupid dog. Mm-hmm. Dog is so stupid, or they get really angry, and, you know, that old trope is still there. It's like, it's all about dominance, and, you know, they're not respecting me as a leader of the pack. And that's so not true. It's
right.
Just so often we're miscommunicating because we're on sort of the human channel and they're on the canine channel. We're not that good at putting ourselves in our dog's place. And that's why books like this are so important for dog lovers and pet lovers. This isn't a book for necessarily, you know, just people who are sort of fascinated in the science. It's a book for people who want to get closer to their dog and understand their dog better. Because so much is labeled as disobedience when it's misunderstanding or seeing the world differently. And and that's one of the reasons I really like this perspective in this book so much.
Yeah. And, you know, it'd be worth it, I think, for you to sort of lay out the book a bit for everybody, Jennifer, so that before we take calls and so forth, which we have callers online, of course.
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of personal stories in here, and I actually start, you know, I wanted it to be a bit of a journey, of my journey as well, because I went into it thinking I knew a lot about dogs and that, well, what am I going to learn? You know, I know all about dogs. I'm a dog whisperer. I'm great at this. And I found, of course, that as I researched the book, that there was a lot that I didn't know and that I needed to rethink. And so I start with some personal experience with my own dogs. Mm-hmm. I get into a bit about the evolution of dogs and just sort of what is that story? What does that look like? How did dogs become this very special animal to us? Because they really are, they're not necessarily smarter than other animals, but they occupy a very special place that I think no other animal has quite filled. And part of that I see as their adaptive intelligence, you know, the idea that they have found a way to live in these two different worlds. They can live on the streets, they can live, you know, with people at the edges of our communities, in our beds. They really have, you know, have a quite an impressive span of ways that they can thrive. So I get into a bit of that. And then I really spent a lot of time with different kinds of working dogs because I wanted to meet the dogs that had had the most opportunity to show their intelligence, whether that was detection dogs of different kinds, whether it was emotional support dogs, whether it's, you know, dogs that are sniffing out Parkinson's in studies, you know, dogs that are the ones that go into schools after there's a tragedy that, you know, that the children can rely on, courtroom dogs, just really the search and rescue, all the different working dogs that we count on for so many things, and that kind of showcase different aspects of what dogs are capable of learning and what they can do. And then the book kind of rounds out with some ideas about how can we learn dogs' language better? How can we communicate? And what are some ways we can kind of give back a little bit of their dogness and just let them be dogs a little bit more and remember that that's okay, that they don't have to be just like us. They can be their own thing and fit beautifully into our lives.
And every one of those areas that you were talking about, you've got just fantastic stories that buttress the science kind of behind us, which is what makes the book so amazing to me.
Yeah.
Such a pleasure to read.
Thank you. Thank you. And the wonderful people I was able to interview who spent time with me during the pandemic, who let me come out with them and observe their dogs being trained, even military dogs, you know, hunting dogs, all kinds of people just let me come in and be part of that world and see what that looks like.
Yeah.
So appreciated that.
And we'll get into some of this later, but I mean, you were let yourself be attacked by a dog.
I did.
And you pretended to be sightless.
Yes.
And be led by a dog. Those are a couple that come right to mind, Patricia.
Yeah, and you know, that section on guide dogs got Jennifer and I into a conversation. We actually had a great talk a while ago, and I ended up writing a blog post on intelligent disobedience. And that leads to so many interesting stories and ideas. And so in guide dogs, basically that means if a dog is asked to move forward at a crosswalk, but there's a car in the crosswalk, the dog is taught to just stop and disobey the human.
Yeah.
And so there's so many stories of dogs actually doing that in so many different fields, and sheep herding and pet dogs and agility dogs. It just goes on and on and on. The ones that are really chilling are the ones of super, super friendly dogs who love everybody until there's that one person and the dog is like, nope. Nope. Not going, nope. Yeah. And that's just sort of makes chills.
Yeah.
Right.
Lots to talk about with our two guests today, author Jennifer Holland. Her book is titled Dog Smart, and the subtitle of that is Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. And with us as well, of course, Patricia McConnell. Great to have them with us. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, the author Jennifer Holland. Her book, Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence, and with Patricia McConnell, our animal behaviorist, author of a number of wonderful books and guides as well on dogs and dog behavior and human behavior as it relates to dogs. And you can join in 800-642-1234. How does your dog show off its intelligence? Love to hear from you. Adrian in Western Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Adrian. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, we have a 12-year-old German short-haired pointer. And ever since he was very young, we've taken him on runs in, you know, Midwest wooded trails and mountain trails. And he's always, he's always known when we get to an intersection of the trail that he needs to stop and make sure that he continues on the correct way that we're going. And I was wondering, did he pick that up from cues that we gave him, you know, from a young age? Or is that something that dogs sort of know, you know, more innately? Thank you.
Yeah, I think we could both answer that. I'll start by saying, I think that's something that is is relatively easy for a dog to learn organically. And, you know, if mm-hmm. you just think about it, you know, what happens is you're on a walk and you have a choice about, you know, which road, which mm-hmm. road is less traveled, right? Which one are you going to take? And the dog just starts learning to read your visual cues. You know, they're going to go this way. And I don't know which way they're going to go. I don't know about you. Sometimes when I have a young dog, I will purposefully wait until they're not watching me. This is in a safe situation, right? Hmm. But I'll purposely wait till they're not watching me, and then I'll take the trail they're not on, and then wait a little bit. And little puppies, do this with young dogs. Don't do this with a dog who runs off on you. Please, please, please. But basically, I will just go the other way, and then I will hide. But I'm close enough, I can see the dog. And these sweet little adolescents, you know, their head will come up, and it's like, oh, wait.
Where'd they go?
I lost her. So it teaches them to sort of extra pay attention. But I think that's the kind of thing that dogs are programmed to learn inherently, right?
Yeah, I would think. And just that bond that they are having with their person, they want to go with you, most likely. I mean, they may have a moment of stray where they want to sniff something. But for the most part, I feel they're paying much closer attention than we realize and picking up cues, invisible cues, or things that we wouldn't see.
I love that one section in your book where when you were talking about picking up cues, and people are always saying, how did it know that I was, you know, how are they waiting at the door for me?
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about that in the book.
Yeah, they just have that kind of sense. It feels like magic a little bit, you know,
yeah.
That they seem to know, you know, well before I'm going to take him for a walk, he knows, even though I'm just sure I haven't given him any cues at all. I've been very quiet. I haven't used any of the words. I haven't jingled the collar. And yet somehow they kind of are a step ahead of us, I feel sometimes.
And I want to give Adrian some props because he mentioned that his dog was a German Shorthair Pointer.
Yeah.
They are not famous for paying attention to their mm-hmm. humans. So that's an impressive relationship because some dogs are way more likely to sort of be human, you know, be person yeah. owner focused than others. So props to Adrian because that's a really strong bond that he has with that dog. That's
yeah.
really sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. Carol in McFarland, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. My husband and I have been huge fans of Dr. McConnell's for many years, and it enabled us to move beyond the beg and plead method of dog training that we've been using, with much better success, but we're about ready to get a puppy. We had to put down our 12-year-old Australian Shepherd, and now we're ready to get a puppy. And I've been paying a little bit of attention to training methods that don't use treats, and I wondered if there's been any shift in focus on that.
Oh, I love that you asked that question. Do we have an hour left, Larry? It's easily answered in an hour, if I could have that. So here's where my thinking is on treats. That's probably the best way I can address it, is I love using treats. I absolutely adore using treats. I use them often. But it's really important to, one, vary the reinforcement. So everybody who knows me knows that I am all about positive reinforcement as much as absolutely possible, which is usually 99.9999% of the time. So I love using treats, but I'd never suggest always using treats. What I think is really important with a young dog is to vary them, is so you have varied reinforcements. So dogs aren't always hungry, right? Maybe they don't like the treat you have in the pocket. Some dogs don't care, shockingly. Don't tell my Maggie this, but some dogs actually don't care about, I don't know, 6-month-old dried kibble you found in your pocket, which she would, you know, kill for. But so there's lots of other reinforcements. There's, especially with puppies, there's running away and letting them chase you. Great way to teach calm. There's belly rubs. There's play. There's throwing toys. There's all, you know, and really, what does the dog want? I mean, that's the best way to look at it. What is my dog most willing to work for right now? And you can use that as the reinforcement. Say your dog wants to go outside. Well, that's the reinforcement for being polite at the door. They're polite, then you open the door. So I'm a big fan of using food treats, but also feel very strongly that you should have a whole, a big menu for you to be able to use.
And Jennifer, you talk about that a bit in your book as well.
A little bit, yeah. One of what it brings to mind is there was a study using MRI where they were trying to show what do dogs prefer. And of course, it's going to vary across, you know, from dog to dog. But they did show that there were dogs that, according to the what's happening in the brain, that preferred praise from their owner over treats, or at least at that moment. And so I think exactly what Patricia's saying, there's going to be, I'm sure it varies at different times of day and different dogs, but to have options, even just down to something like praise, which many dogs really do crave from us.
And you know that, if I could just jump in, that study was surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But you know, the more I think about it, I find it fascinating because imagine the dog in an MRI. I don't know if you've had one, but, you know, you go into this little dark tunnel, and they used to be way more scary than they are now, but nonetheless, you basically go into this place that's incredibly loud and noisy and confined, and then you can't move. It's like, don't move.
Yeah.
Like, you have to
it's
teach
terrifying.
A dog to do that. So I think sometimes it is useful to be anthropomorphic. So imagine you're nervous, you're in this confined place, you're told not to move. What I would want most is probably my husband saying, you know, hey, babe,
it's
right
okay.
here.
You're
you know,
fine. Yeah.
The last MRI I had, I'm really claustrophobic, and one of the attendants held my hand.
Yeah.
And that was everything. And I would do a lot for a piece of chocolate, but I didn't want one right there.
Yeah,
so
that's a great
one
point.
One of the things to think about that I think this study that is so important is like context. Context is huge, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the story you tell in there about getting the dog, the fellow who trained his dog just to walk up there, lay his head down.
Yeah. Just the fact that we can train them to do that, that they're willing, if we train them properly, that you can probably convince a dog to do just about anything, I guess, if you have the right methods. But it is. It's remarkable that they can do that, that they can lie still enough for those, you know, scans to be useful and readable. That was
amazing.
Just, yeah, really incredible.
Absolutely. Justin and Waupaca emailed. They have come to realize their lab plot hound mix is dumb like a fox. When a transaction is obviously beneficial to him, he is capable of great feats of understanding and genius. But when the interaction is to their benefit, in other words, to Justin's benefit, he makes a decision about whether or not he wants to help us out.
Yeah. Oh, I have to tell you, I
love that.
As someone who has the same time had border collies, known for being exceedingly caring deeply about what you want and working as a team. I mean, they were bred to work as a team with you while being basically predatory.
Yeah.
So that's pretty huge. And on the other hand, I also have had Great Pyrenees sheep guarding dogs because of all the coyotes around our place. And they're basically the opposite. They were bred to live by themselves with sheep and protect them from predators. And so Tulip and Bo Peep, both of mine, especially Tulip, had this look. It was very special. I can see a plot hound doing it, absolutely, which is you ask them to come, you know, they're 50 feet away, you ask them to come, and they turn and they look at you, and you can literally see their brains going like, I don't know.
Is it worth it?
Should I? Is it worth it? So you just have to work way harder on those dogs than you do with a Labrador or a Border Collie.
Karen in Madison, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. We bought a Border Collie from Trish many years ago, and he lived 15 years. And we the family with two boys loved him. The question was, when my father came, who was severely ill and near death, the Border Collie, who normally wasn't a you know, one person dog, totally sat with him, would put his feet, his body over my father's feet. So the question is, what did he sense as, you know, why this man was so severely ill?
And Jennifer, thank you.
That's a wonderful question.
You cover that in your book, and
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it is I think I think about that as emotional intelligence. I think there's also probably olfaction going on. I think dogs really sense illness. They smell when something is off. That's why so many dogs we find can pick up on diseases before your doctor diagnoses you. You know, the dog might let you know that you have a tumor growing. So I think they really do sense that. And of course, in their own lives as dogs, they need to know the difference between well and sick. So it makes a lot of sense just evolutionarily that they would be able to pick out if something is wrong. But I think that's where that caring and sort of empathy and love that we feel from our dogs, I think that's where you really feel it the most is in a situation like that.
Yeah, I remember a story from the book you were telling about training a dog to detect a certain disease, and I've forgotten which one it was. But there were... The training involved having a sample of who had the disease and then several controls. And the dog kept going to one of the controls.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
this was a case where the dog, you know, was responding or was doing the cue that there was cancer in this sample that the study leaders felt was a control sample. And it turned out that person that had given that sample did have cancer. It was a different kind of cancer. And they ended up going and getting checked, you know, again after this circumstance and found out ultimately that they did have a different kind of cancer. So the dog was not incorrect. It was just not the thing that they were looking
not
for.
Not that exact cancer.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
and
still new.
That goes back to that olfactory intelligence that Jennifer was talking about. You know, I don't remember any of the details, but I know increasingly, maybe I read it in your book, but our physiology changes. You know, there's some animals. There was a book written about a cat at a nursing home who knew who was about to die within 48 hours. I forget the name of it. I'm so sorry, but you can Google it.
Yes, I remember that story.
And it was well documented. It wasn't just sort of some happy Disney, you know, made up story. So there's a suggestion that there's something different about the way, I think it's proteins are processed, or there are physiological changes when the body starts to shut down. And that some animals can sense that and act on it. It might be that all animals can sense that,
right.
But it doesn't matter to them, right? It's
exactly.
Not salient.
Yeah.
We are just beginning to understand this amazing world that other animals live in that, you know, that we're often not.
Oh, that's what I like so much about Jennifer's book. There are one of the things I really like about it. There are so many things. And I've had a lot of opportunities, you know, probably more than maybe the average lay person to talk about dogs and dog behavior.
You think, Larry?
And I'm many things surprised and encouraged me and obviously made me feel pretty good, you know, as I read your stories and the work that's going on there. Well, Ellen's got a story. Speaking of stories, let's go there. Ellen in Madison, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a story about an interaction between my dog and another dog. My dog was absolutely fear reactive to other dogs. And this golden retriever, who had never encountered my dog before, just absolutely laid down and froze in place and stayed frozen while my dog approached and sniffed her and nuzzled her and then backed away. And when we were again about 100 yards away, the golden popped up like, oh boy, everybody's friendly again. How did that happen?
Patricia, what do you think?
Well, that's a great story. And, you know, I think so many things played into that. One is the golden reading your dog, first of all. Right? You know, really, really, really good social intelligence, which some dogs have more than others, partly based on their genetics, a lot based on their early environment. So tremendous social intelligence. This dog is uncomfortable and nervous around me. So and then the dog just lying down and freezing, it's like, I'm just going to be as unobtrusive and as unintimidating as I possibly could be. I'm circling back to Karen, who I wanted to say hi, the caller who bought a border collie puppy from me a million years ago. I didn't breed very much. I bred maybe 3 or 4 litters. I'm guessing it was a puppy from Pip. Pippi Tay was the sweetest thing in the world, and she worked dog-dog aggression cases for me for years, and she was brilliant. I would have people crying because their dog played with Pip for the first time ever in their life, because not only were her skills, social skills, great, but she made choices that made me want to say she cared deeply, you know? I mean, she could have just said, fine, I'll just ignore you. And she was like, no, I'm going to lie down 50 feet away from you and look all submissive and grinny and wag my tail and thump my tail on the ground. But if you look at me, I'll turn my head away. I mean, she worked it really carefully. Very carefully stripped. It's like, this is, and she really seemed to get like, this is my job. She was literally worth her weight in gold as a behaviorist. So what a beautiful interaction for you to describe between these two dogs, finding ways to get along.
Yeah.
You talk about that a bit, dog interactions with each other in your book, Jennifer.
Yeah, and just that robust communication that they have, all the subtleties of that. And that's, again, where I came into it thinking I could read dogs pretty well. And when I really started to pay attention, I noticed so much more happening. And you know, there's a lot of things that can mean one thing or another thing, depending on, you know, the opposite thing, depending on the context. And that's where I think as owners, we often fail.
Well, give me an example or two.
For example, I think the way the tail wags can mean a lot. Yeah. And Patricia can chime in. But, you know, which way it's going, which quadrant it's wagging in, whether it's between the legs or up and going in a circle. There's like the happy, joyful wag. There's the more fearful wag. I'm sure there's tail postures that are suggest, you know, I'm not very happy with you and watch out, you know. So just they use every appendage. They use their ears, their eye expressions, their hair on the back, all of it together tells a story, I think, about that moment. And we just, we're not always as good at reading them as they are each other and us.
Mm. Jill in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Oh, thank you for taking my call. And I am so excited to read this book. So I have had several different breeds of dogs, Black Lab, Belgian Malinois, and then we adopted a Siberian Husky. And wow, I believe that it's a human trapped in the dog body.
What makes possible
those dogs so different than other dogs I've ever had? They are just really incredible communicators, but yet willful. Oh my gosh.
So how do they communicate? How does this particular dog communicate, this husky communicate to you, Jill? I mean,
he's very cautious. There's always a 10-second delay in anything we ask him to do. Mm-hmm. There is just a sweetness about him, but he is, if you take him for a walk, he is determined to want to go where he wants to go. He will compromise, but there just seems to be, it's his way or the highway.
Okay.
I've just never experienced that in other dogs that I've had. And what makes, and I hear this from so many other people that own Huskies, what makes them different? What is it that breed is known for being so willful?
And that, I assume there's a lot of vocalizing. Is that, that's what I've seen. I have never had a husky, but just all that vocalization and all the passion and frustration behind it sometimes, and just chiming in with every sound that it hears that sounds a little bit like a howl. They're funny. I don't know. They're probably not for everyone, but I think they're just amazing.
Yeah.
They talk in W's, right? Lots of W's. You know, one of the things that's so helpful is to sort of go back and look at genetics and what were dogs bred for. Because we've had such a profound effect on what we now see, and Jennifer talks about this in her book, is village dogs as a separate well, some biologists would call it a species, others absolutely would not, but basically a whole different creature than a domestic family dog, than a companion domestic dog. But so, I mean, look at all the intensive breeding that's gone on for function. And what were huskies bred to do, right? Move, run, go, and make a lot of independent decisions. You know, I know some people who work sled dog teams very seriously and talk about intelligent disobedience. You know, they talk about life-saving moments when their huskies went like, nope, not going on that ice because we're all going to die if we do, you know. And also many, many examples of the huskies who took off just for fun because they wanted to, that endangered the human's life, right? They are bred to be smart, intelligent, and super, super, super active. And so if I had a husky, I would be exhausted. First of all, I would spend so much time exercising their brains. I would teach them a gazillion tricks because it's hard to physically get a husky enough physical exercise, which would be great. Absolutely do that whenever you can. But mental exercise tends to take a lot of energy. Brains use up a lot of energy, right? So I would have that dog trained to do so many tricks, it would slump in exhaustion by 5 o'clock. So I could too.
I love that. I that was something that surprised me a little to learn was how much that using that mental capacity uses up energy as well. Because we're always, you know, we got to take the dog for a walk, and I think of it as exercise is the important part, and really what's probably more important is letting them sniff and experience, you know, things on that walk. And so my rushing along just because I want him to move his legs is not what he needs. He needs to be using his brain during that walk.
I have the privilege of taking care of a very large border dog, Lila, and she. When I get her for 9 days or 8 or 9 days, when we go for walks, I let her pick where she wants to go.
Nice.
And we'll go, we'll be in town, and if we'll come to a corner and she'll look at me and I'll look at her and say, where do you want to go? She might sit there for a while and smell around a little bit, and then she'll decide, and then we'll go off in that direction. Of course, if we're near my house, she immediately wants to go to Atwood Avenue, which is the site of not one, but two ice cream shops. One gets where she gets a dog treat, and then the other one, I have to buy a doggy ice cream
the
cone.
Which, cup.
Yeah, they're not real ice cream, but they're a little cone with something that's kind of like ice cream, but it's made, you know, it's for dogs, and then with a little dog treat on top of it. So
I thought you were going to say she buys you an ice cream cone.
But we've got to go that to the first spot for the one, and then we got to go through this, go into the store, and then that one I'll buy maybe a little ice cream for myself. But then afterwards, she'll want to circle back to that, but I just let her go. And we might be out there for an hour and a half, you know.
And that's wonderful. Brilliant, Larry. And it brings up something that I think is so important for our family dogs, which is getting back to the conversation we were having earlier about olfaction and how, you know, as Jennifer was saying, what the primary perspective that basically dogs use to sort of orient themselves and center themselves in the environment. And that gets overridden by humans so often, and it causes so many troubles. And dogs do vary. I mean, a lot of people know I have two border collies, Skip and Maggie. Maggie is, when you take her to a new place, I have just learned, I don't ask her to do anything. She can't. She literally can't. She has to stand still and sniff the air. And then she has to sniff the ground. So I put her, you know, if there's a place where she can be off leash, I don't let her off leash for the first 20 seconds. She has to orient. Skip, on the other hand, is like, whatever, what do you want to do? But they need time to smell. So yay for you, Larry, for giving your dog agency, but also for understanding that she needs to sit there and use her nose to decide where to go, not necessarily her eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all, and I have that advantage because I know when I'm going to have her, and I can make sure that I've got the time to do it. But I do get nervous sometimes. I do a jog every morning, and I see some folks running with their dogs, and the dog may. I know the dog wants to stop and smell the starts, but then the dog gets pulled away and just keep running, and it makes me kind of sad sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also understand.
Take your dog on a stop.
What I hope is, my hope is that at another point of the day, the dog's getting to do what?
They do a sniff instead of a walk for later in the day, maybe.
Talking today with Jennifer Holland, author of Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence, and also with Patricia McConnell, who has quoted in Jennifer's book more than once, as a matter of fact, about her work as well as with dogs. You can join in. How does your dog show its intelligence? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at intelligence in dogs with Jennifer Holland. Her book is Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. And with Patricia McConnell, who's been with us on the many programs here with me on WPR News. And questions, I hope you'll join in. Galsy in La Crosse has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Galsy.
Hi. We have a 10-year-old collie who's a rough coat, sable-colored collie, and he goes to daycare sometimes. Occasionally, there's another collie that shows up at this daycare, and inevitably, our collie goes over to the other collie, and they hang out all day together, as if they recognize one another. The other collie looks like him. Do dogs of the same breed have a way to recognize one another?
I don't know if it's of the same breed, but dogs can certainly recognize one another, can they not?
It's certainly.
Jennifer, you have exam. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you just the way your dog reacts to other dogs when you're out, it's much more aimed at the other dog than at the person walking the dog, for example. But whether a particular breed recognizes you know, the same breed? That's a really interesting question. I mean, I guess visually, I don't know. They don't really look in the mirror, so I don't know that they know what they look like. But interesting
yeah,
question.
It is a very, I haven't seen any research on it. No. There's a little bit about recognizing your litter mates or your mother.
Yeah.
That suggests that, yes, they do.
There's some smell involved there, perhaps.
Possibly, but I have to say, as a uber social species. I mean, one of the reasons we get along with dogs so well is that they are hyper social. They are abnormally social compared to most mammals. And if you live in groups and you're hyper social and your life depends on other members of your pack, then how could you not be attuned to something that looks like the individuals you grew up with? So you don't need to look in a mirror. You just need to know who you grew up with. You know, what does your mother look like? What do your siblings look like? And, I mean, I see suggested evidence of this all the time. Years ago, I had a border collie who ran into an English bulldog. And he actually did not run into the English bulldog. He literally turned and tried to run away. He was terrified of this monster thing that I don't think he knew it was a dog until he could smell and get closer. So I would love to see the research, but I can't imagine how they wouldn't. It just makes so much sense logically. Jennifer, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so too. It just evolutionarily in every way, that would make sense.
It does bring the question up of self-awareness. I mean, and I'm just trying to remember in your book if you dealt with that.
Yeah.
And you do deal with that in the book.
Yeah, that
talk
was
about that a bit.
A very interesting question of, you know, what does it mean to be self-aware, first of all? But what I talk about in the book is the idea that, you know, the study or the test that we would use to determine self-awareness doesn't necessarily make sense for a dog. And so I believe it was Alexandra Horowitz who did the first study where she thought about how can we do what they call the mirror test, the idea of if I look into the mirror and there's a dot painted on me, do I realize it's on me or do I reach for the mirror thinking that it's separate from me? Mm-hmm. And she thought, well, why would a dog care about a dot on its fur if it might not even know itself that way? Scent is what's important for a dog. So let's do an olfactory mirror test and see if the dog recognizes its own scent, like its own urine scent, for example. And in those kinds of studies, they found that the dog do seem to be self-aware. They do have a different response, more interest in a stranger's urine scent than in their own, for example.
Sure.
And so it was just a matter of shifting your thinking. Well, that doesn't make sense if we're studying this other species that, you know, sees itself, quote unquote, in a different way. And let's think about what makes sense in that case and design a study that really fits that animal.
Yeah, that was an interesting piece of research. I remember that well. And you talked about other animals at the same time and the way they've been tested for self-awareness as sort of a preamble to what you just told us. So there you go. I thought that was really interesting. Laura in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Hi, Laura.
Hi. My question is, I have a 10-year-old black lab, and I retired a few years ago. So I feed him about the same time every day. But he, about a half hour before, doesn't matter what I'm doing in the house, he'll just sit like 10 feet from me and stare at me. And if, as it gets closer to the time, if I'm not moving towards the booth, he will start talking to me. You know, he does the arr, 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 and he jumps up and down. And how does he know what time it is?
Well, a couple of things. One is that he doesn't need to know what time it is, right? He needs to know if he's hungry or not. And so, I mean, the whole... I know so little about this, but there's a whole field of study about external clocks and internal biological clocks and physiology. And we know that internal physiology is strongly related to the sort of internal clock we have related to external cues. And so he could just be, it's like, okay, I'm getting hungry. I mean, it could be that simple. But I think there are other circumstances where, like, for example, I think Jennifer might talk about this, about how does a dog know you're 20 minutes away coming home? Why is the dog sitting at the window, even if you're coming home at a different time or even the same time? So, you know, there's so much we have to learn about what cues are salient and what cues animals are learning. But I'm not surprised at all. Skip and Maggie would be like, that's trivial. You know, when it's time to get our chew toy, you know, we're like staring at Trisha, right? Sometimes she's stupid enough to ignore it, you know, right?
Silly humans. We don't read them. Yeah, it is interesting how they just seem to know. And I, you know, I try not to feed my dogs at the same exact time every night because I don't want them to get into a habit like that. I prefer for them to be just, you know, they're just going to be it's in my decision on that particular one.
But didn't you also write about yourself trying to not let the dog know that you were going out, taking it for a walk?
Yes, yes.
Tell that story.
Yeah, my dog Monk, who's a Kai Ken, he's a Japanese breed, kind of an unusual breed. Very sweet, lovely dog. My oxytocin dog, I call him, because he's the one that gazes lovingly into my eyes. I've kind of tested myself to see, can I make sure that I give him no clue and see, you know, how does he know anyway? So I'll do absolutely nothing except, you know, maybe give my husband the look like, okay, we're going to do the walk shortly, but I'm not going to go to the leash yet. I'm not going to say any words. And yet he's looking at me and he starts to get excited and, you know, just somehow it just steamrolls into, I guess it's time to go.
More to talk about with our two guests today, Jennifer Holland. Her book is called Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. Patricia McConnell with us as well. It's great to have them both here. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30. But we'll take a quick look now at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with the author of the book Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. She's one of our guests, the author Jennifer Holland. Great to have her with us. It's a lovely book, wonderful book, and I hope you'll have a chance to read it and maybe get it. Well, if not, buy it. Go to your library and make sure they buy one. She's also a contributor to the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, National Geographic. I think she's got a desk there somewhere as well. So great to have her with us. Patricia McConnell, back certified applied animal behaviorist, an author of many books as well. And we're talking about your dog's intelligence. What do you want to know about the way your dog thinks? How does your dog exhibit its intelligence? Give a call, shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And just to mention, too, coming up at 12:30, we'll be visiting with a doctor from the UW Vet School, and she is part, Dr. Heidi Callahan, part of the cardio unit there. And so we'll talk about cardio issues and what they do as it relates to dogs and cats. So that's at 12:30. But right now we're talking about your dog's intelligence. And Barb and Monroe, oh, before we go to Barb, I want to go back because I promised I'd bring this up at the beginning, and I'm afraid it's going to go away if I don't mention it. You put yourself in a lot of positions, and one of them was to allow yourself to be attacked by a dog, and I did bring that up, and I want to be sure to mention it. Otherwise, yeah, Somebody's going to email me and be mad at me.
Yeah, it's a little crazy of me, perhaps, but I had the opportunity to be on the other side of a bite dog, a police dog, and to be the perp, and to be, you know, sort of hunted down and taken down. It could have taken me down. Kindly, the policeman got the dog off of me before that happened. But that's an intense experience. This was a Belgian Malinois, so anyone who knows them knows they can be, you know, that's not a dog you want to have running towards you with its teeth bared. But just an amazing thing that these dogs can be trained to. They're loving and sweet, wonderful dogs, and they're part of that world. But then they can be trained in the right circumstance to show their other side, and additionally to let go when they're told to, which I think is also really interesting. That, you know, the reward for the bite dog is the bite, and yet they have to, if the policeman says no, you know, stop or whatever the word is they're using, the dog has to drop and stop, not finish that moment that it wanted to finish, that it was trained to finish.
So, and you were padded up.
I was padded. The suit was a bit big on me, so I was kind of sliding around in there. But I had a pretty big bruise on my arm after that. That is no joke to be on the other side of one of those dogs.
Well, the interesting thing for me in that experience was, and you made a comment about it, they can go home and play with
the kids.
The kids.
Yeah. Absolutely. They know.
It's like they're two different dogs.
Yes.
How do they?
That's exactly it. They know when they're working and they know when that's not appropriate anymore. And I never, ever had a sense that there was any crossover there, that there was any concern or any incident with this dog, you know, misinterpreting a situation at home and suddenly becoming a police dog in that context.
That's an amazing story.
There's some. Yeah. Oh, there's so much there. And yay for you for being brave.
I guess. Naive.
Well, brave. So much to talk about. And I think one of the most important things to know is that if these dogs are trained correctly, they are not attacking a human.
Right.
That is not what they're trained to do. What they're trained to do is to play this game, this really cool game, where you get to lunge at this big, huge padded thing that happens to be on somebody's arm. And hang on until you're told to get off. Now, having them get off does not always go quite as well as some police departments, frankly, would like you to know. I actually work with a client from a police department who shall be unnamed, who had this beautiful Malinois, adored him. He was this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous dog, but he wouldn't let go. They have to have a test once a year, mm-hmm. And one of the tests is that they're trained
let
to
go.
Attack, and then they're trained to let go. And the dog wouldn't, although he had in real life. Twice he'd actually been sent after somebody and had let go that second in the street, but in the test he wouldn't. They had literally, this police department, not the owner, well, under their instruction, the owner had given no choice but to put an electric shock collar both on the dog's neck and the dog's testicles.
Mm.
And he came to me, he said, I just can't bear doing that. It's just making me sick. And I knew very little about this sport. But the simplest thing in the world, I watched a couple of videos, I thought about it, and I thought, what is this dog, what is this dog's reinforcement? And he wasn't getting reinforced. And what I finally figured out watching one of the old videos was that what he wants is a sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as they would say us or whatever, that's the wrong pronunciation, I forget
los,
it.
I think los.
Los.
I could be wrong.
Yeah,
too.
we're both
somewhere in there.
Somewhere
dodging
in there.
Somewhere
the
in the
German,
vicinity of the correct word.
It was German.
They would just pull the sleeve off and let him run around with the sleeve.
Right.
And so that's what I did. And he was like, fine. So I have mixed feelings about canine police dogs who are used to perform this function.
Yeah.
But you're a very brave woman.
Oh,
I just gotta say. thought about it. It's like, no, you need to bring somebody else to be the victim while I'm the behaviorist and I watch and I analyze and I instruct, but I got nothing to do.
But that's a great point about it being a game. And I think I forgot to mention that, too. But I think that's often the case in these situations. It's really all a game to them. And it's about just training them what the rules are of the game.
Yeah. Barb in Monroe has something. Let's go there. Hi, Barb.
Well, hi there. I'm Barb, and I got many years ago, I adopted a dog that had been abused just by neglect. And this dog, once I got a hold of it when it was 5 months old, would just do anything to please. He learned to use the bathroom, one, two, and flush it when he was done. And at night, if there'd be a storm coming, he would breathe into my face first to try to wake me up. I'd tell him, go back to bed, Rusty. Then he'd jangle his chains as the storm's coming closer. Go back to bed, Rusty. It's still okay. It's okay. Well, with the storm coming closer and he thinking it's very dangerous, he'd run in the bathroom and flush the toilet. And that meant code red, everybody to the basement. And
wow.
That's exactly what we do.
Oh, my gosh. That's an amazing story.
if you could see me and Jennifer, my mouth is
mouth's
on
wide
my
open.
My chin is on my right. We're both like, wow.
Wish I had that one in the book. That's a great story.
Yeah, no kidding.
That is, well, you've got plenty of really great stories in the book, believe
she
does
me.
But
indeed.
That's a dandy, Barb.
I got to tell you, though, this spring in southern Wisconsin, if you had a dog who flushed the toilet, you'd need an entirely new water pump because there were so many
storms.
It was a nightmare for a lot of people and a lot of dogs.
Paul in Portage, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul from Portage. back in 2010, I worked in an office with three other people. We each had our own cubicle, and the owner would always bring her dog, which was a Blue was his name, Black Lab. And the dog would always just lay with the loner. Just lay with the owner. And suddenly, that dog would come and lay by my chair and go across the hallway and lay with this other girl's chair. And Blue would go back and forth between her and I. And this went on for quite a while. And it turned out we both had cancer surgery on the same day.
Wow.
Wow.
Incredible. Yeah, that's just amazing. And it's, even though it's not surprising anymore, it still gives you a little moment of chill that they can do that and that they'll kind of show you that they're noticing this. It's not just that they notice.
Yeah. Paul,
a good point that not only can they perceive it, but Jennifer's point that then they acted on it, then because of their dogness, because of this miraculous bond we have with this whole other species who's just so different from us, so very different from us. These dogs were making this choice to basically, like, you know, we can make up all kinds of stories. We don't know why exactly they made that choice. You know, did they go over there to be there in support? Did they go over there to, like, have us notice something? Did they go over there because the person's cancer made them nervous and they, you know, needed, you know? So we don't know why they did it, but still, you know, how many individuals of how many species who could detect that?
Sure.
Because lots of animals could. Mm-hmm. Would make that choice. It speaks to this astounding relationship we have with domestic dogs.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think your cat's gonna do that.
Well, but some cats do.
No, that's
right?
True.
Some
the cat
do.
We talked about before.
Yeah but I don't know about. Well, it's interesting then, isn't it? Because I was gonna say I don't know about an African gray. It's like, oh wait, talk to Irene Pepperberg. It's
exactly.
Like, yes, Alex probably would have done that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. So that. Begs the question to me. It's like, what animal species wouldn't have done that?
Yeah.
I'm thinking
maybe that's
scorpion.
The way to think about it. My pet scorpion.
Your pet scorpion.
Well, I tell you what, our dogs are so helpful to us. And you write about ways that we can be better humans for our dogs. And I wanted to make sure that we touch on some of that. Learning to speak a dog's language is one of the things.
Yeah.
And it's a little different than me learning to speak somebody's Spanish.
Right.
It's not that way. Talk about
that. Yeah, I think that was a big one for me was really just taking the time to learn that body language and to be more observant, to not make so many assumptions about what your dog feels and thinks, and not to assume that the same thing that's going to bother you or that's going to make you feel good is going to, you know, make the dog feel the same way. Just being more mindful that they're a different species and they have a different way of expressing themselves, expressing emotions, what needs they have, what's important to them. And I just, yeah, I think there's ways just, you know, sort of subtle ways even just to be a little bit more aware of that. And to keep that in mind, I guess, when you're, you know, building up your expectations about what your dog should be doing or how they should be responding.
Yeah. I was thinking about Lila again. And Lila has different ways. I've learned that she might bark once or to go outside to pee. But if she wants a treat, she does a different kind of bark.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a fascinating thing. We had a dog that used to, we called her bark a snake bark because we used to have snakes. My husband bred snakes for a while, which is a whole other story. Every once in a while, one might, a tank might be left open just a crack at night and a snake would escape. And this dog was a Shiba Inu. And she had a very particular bark that every time we heard it, we knew that she had found one of the snakes hiding somewhere under the fax machine or whatever it was. I'm dating myself with the fax machine. But it was very distinctive, and it always was correct. It was just so I think they really, the vocalizations can be very distinctive for different circumstances.
And how, you know, I was thinking, what about other ways that we can be better humans for our dog? The one that came to mind we talked about already, and that's letting the dog walk and be a dog.
Yeah, and making choices and letting them use their natural tools, mm-hmm. letting them use olfaction. But another one, which I think Patricia can speak to, is setting them up for success by, you know, training them well so they know what we want. And I'm certainly no expert at this, and I wouldn't say my dog behavior shows that I'm particularly good trainer, but I think my sense is that if you're going to have expectations of your dog living in our niche, you know, you have to tell them what that is, and you have to train them well enough that they can get it right. And if they're not getting it right, it's probably something you've done, right? You haven't trained them well enough or the way that dog needs to be trained.
You know, that leads into, we were talking earlier about self-awareness, you know, do dogs have self-awareness? One of the things that you find as a trainer behaviorist working with people with dogs with behavioral issues is how unself-aware people are about their own behavior. And so one of the first things to learn to improve your relationship with your dog is discover what you do. Because most people don't know, and they move their bodies in ways they're not even aware of. Dogs learn all these visual signals. You know, I actually taught a dog to sit by pulling my hands together, sort of folding my hands at my, you know, at my belly. Because I would do that, and I would be like, what am I going to ask this little puppy to do? Sit or lie down or whatever? And so, and it was usually before sit. So I would make this gesture, and the dogs would sit. And it took me a couple of weeks to figure out I had trained them to sit to this. So when you're working with people with their dog, it's shocking, frankly, in a very benevolent way, how people are completely unaware of how their bodies move, of the way they use their voice, of the tones of their voice. And so one of the best things you can do is not just, as Jennifer was saying, learn to read your own dog, which is if you get a bunch of animal behaviors and science-based dog trainers together and you ask them, what is the most important thing you could do to decrease dog bites? It's that. Learn to read dogs. Because dogs are always telling us, please do not pet me. Please do not walk forward. Please, please, please. And people are not reading that. But then to learn to use your own body. I've always said for a million years that dog training is a science, a sport, and an art. And the sport part is learning how to use your body and your voice to communicate effectively. Because we often will say one thing with our voices and the exact opposite with our bodies, like calling a dog to come. You say, come, and then you move forward. You just told your dog to stop.
Instead of moving backwards.
You just told your dog to stop. Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a great point.
And you've had, and in your book, Jennifer, there was a kind of go along with all this. There was a dog that shows up several times, Odin.
Yes.
I believe. And you do a marvelous job of explaining how this dog, who looked like he might tear your throat out, how you were able to approach and actually become great friends with this dog.
Yeah.
Even on a very emotional level.
Yeah. He's very special. I actually just spent some time with him the last few days, and it was really wonderful to have him remember me because I hadn't seen him in a long time and to respond, you know, affectionately toward me. But he's a dog, a mountain cur is the breed, and just not a dog that likes everyone, certainly one that you have to be a little bit wary and you know, learn how to approach. And I really found that just the timing of meeting him and the different times that I got to be with him, I was using what I was learning doing the research for the book to improve my relationship with him or to establish one to begin with. And it started with, you know, me just being kind of this sort of a little scared of him and figuring out, you know, don't be a primate. Don't run up and try to hug this dog. Don't stick your hand in his face. Figure out, you know, what is going to work with this particular dog. And over time, he did. He became kind of an emotional support dog for me.
Yeah.
During a time when my father was dying and this dog was in my life at that point. And it was just kind of neat how he's a thread through that entire part of my life.
Yeah, very a touching part of the book. I loved that part a lot. Well, what do you think? What is there one thing that you want people to take from your book? What's the big takeaway that you want readers to have? I mean, they're going to be entertained. They're going to learn an awful lot about dogs. But what's that one takeaway, you think?
I think for me, it's been not assuming that you know and going into this relationship with this other animal, appreciating them for their non-humanness, you know, appreciating the dogness in them and what that means for the world that they live in, and that it's right beside us, but it's different. You know, they're experiencing it differently. And if we keep that in mind, it helps, I think, in terms of how we respond and how what we give back to dogs, how we let them use the natural tools and give them opportunities to do what they naturally want to do, whether it's sniffing or just all out running or playing rough or, you know, whatever that looks like, rolling in something. Sometimes I think it's worth just allowing them that, because I think it's really good for them to express their dogness and not always be under the umbrella of our manners and our training and all the things that we expect of them.
Well, I know Lila always likes, after the visit to the second ice cream shop, the one thing she likes to do, well, we have to stop at the beauty shop as well, because they are, in the summer they'll have the door open, and she knows that they have treats and they love to see her. But then after that, we go around the corner, and there's a kind of a wide area between the street and the sidewalk, and she has to lay on her back and shimmy back and forth. And I've often wondered, well, I didn't see any poop there. But there's something there, because she has to do that every single time we have ever walked in that direction.
And you know what? Wonderful. I don't think we've... Jennifer, maybe you could correct me, but I've never seen any research that solved, that answered that question. What are they putting scent on them?
Right.
Or are they putting their scent on the ground, or both, which I think is very possible.
Yeah.
There's one very popular hypothesis that they're covering their body with a different scent so that they're not perceived as a dog by prey animals. And I think that's just ridiculous, which is not going to make me a lot of friends, because that's a very popular hypothesis among the world of science. I think that's just crazy, given working predatory sheepdogs and sheep and watching all those interactions. My guess is that they are primarily putting a scent on themselves because they love really stinky, horrible dead fish, fox poop,
yeah,
and come out of it like, look at me, look at me, right? So, yeah. So
the perfume.
Speaks just really quickly to letting dogs be dogs. Let them roll, you know, let them decide where to go, mm-hmm, and let them chew. That's the one thing we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
Dogs' mouths and heads were designed to chew. Give your dog something to chew on that's safe every day if you possibly can. I really think it's important.
And on that note, we are... finished. We're done. Unfortunately,
no,
because we could talk for another hour at least about about the book Dog Smart: Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. Jennifer, you've written a wonderful book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
This was great fun.
Great fun. And of course, Patricia, my favorite book, as I mentioned earlier, The Other End of the Leash, but there are many that she has written as well. And coming up, we're going to talk about health and cardio and the cardio unit at the UW Vet School. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, the anatomy of a human heart is very similar to a dog or a cat's heart. And that means our hearts often malfunction in the same way. So it's important for us to keep our hearts healthy, whether we walk on two legs or four legs. And Larry Mueller here, by the way. This is Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're focusing on your pet's heart health now. And you're going to learn about some common cardiac conditions in cats and dogs and how to watch out for them. And great to have with us our guest, Dr. Heidi Callahan. She's a clinical professor as well as the sectional head of cardiology for the Department of Medical Sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And so we'll talk with her about that. We'll also talk with her, with Dr. Callahan, about the school's new building, which is providing more space for cardiology services. And I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about your pet's heart health? Maybe your cat or your dog. Maybe your pet already has a heart condition and wondering about the treatment options. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Dr. Heidi Callahan, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me to speak today.
Well, what are the let's start with the most common cardiac conditions that you see in cats and dogs.
Yep. So the most common cardiac conditions that we see in cats and dogs, I'll start with dogs, is what we call degenerative or myxomatous mitral valve disease. So they get degenerative changes of one of their valve leaflets that causes that valve leaflet to leak and can cause the blood volume in their heart to be excessive. And then they can have problems where they'll get fluid in their heart, where a common term that that a lot of people will know is congestive heart failure. So they can get fluid in their lungs. And so we see that a lot in dogs where they have acquired valve disease. We also see a lot of congenital heart disease, meaning that dogs and cats were born with heart disease. And the French Bulldog at the moment is the most popular breed in the United States. And we do see a lot of congenital cardiac abnormalities in a lot of specific breeds. In particular, right now, we see a lot in French Bulldogs. Mm. But there's narrowing of valve leaflets that we see called pulmonic stenosis. You can have narrowing of their aortic leaflets, aortic stenosis. So there's a variety of different congenital abnormalities that both dogs and cats can have or be born with that we see.
And it sounds like that can be that certain breeds are more susceptible then to...
Absolutely.
Cardiac conditions.
Absolutely.
And cats, you know, cats are, they're good at hiding their, you know, if they're sick or they're showing, you know, they're good at hiding signs of illness.
They're very good. Cats are wonderful, wonderful creatures, but we call them aliens sometimes because they don't read the books on how they're supposed to behave or what they're supposed to do. And they are amazing at keeping their illnesses secret from us. And that's a very common history or story when they come in to see us when they have cardiac disease, is that they were doing fine, then all of a sudden they're hiding in the closet or they just didn't want to eat breakfast that morning. And so a lot of times their manifestation of cardiac disease will be very nonspecific. It could just be that they're hiding, they just didn't eat breakfast that morning, they might be breathing a little fast or breathing a little harder, but it can be difficult to originally diagnose or notice that your pet has cardiac disease. And the amazing thing is that once they come to us and we're able to counsel their people on what to look for with cardiac disease, their people become very smart very quickly on being able to identify these early cues that our pets are kind of showing us.
And so the early cues, cue in on that for me a little bit.
Yeah, the early cues are often just not behaving how they normally behave.
Oh, that's an early cue.
That's an early cue. If a cat's just not behaving, being where it likes to be, snuggling with you on the couch, if they're just kind of acting odd, it could mean that there's something going on cardiac-wise or systemically. They manifest their different diseases in different ways, but often it's just not being their normal selves.
Is that true for dogs as well as the cats, or do dogs present differently?
Yeah, dogs with cardiac disease often will present. They're a little more obvious sometimes than cats, but they often present with a cough. If they can't breathe well, they might be coming short of breath. They just can't catch their breath or they keep coughing. So they typically will have a more standard presentation of either falling over. A lot of our patients will fall over with cardiac disease, or difficulty breathing. Those are kind of one of the two big categories that they present with. But a lot of times we see cases where the animals are acting perfectly normal, but their primary care veterinarians have noticed something abnormal, like a murmur or an abnormal heart sound that might send them in our direction.
Mm. And so by falling over, you mean fainting, is essentially correct. Fainting then?
Yes, essentially fainting, yep.
Katie in Hayward has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to give a shout out to Dr. Heidi. Dr. Heidi has been working with the American Lipid Club for years, doing echocardiograms and doing clinics with purebred dogs, trying to solve some of these congenital heart issues that dogs have, so breeders can make better decisions on what dogs they breed based on the research and all the work that she does. She is phenomenal for breeders breeding dogs so that they make good choices to breed healthy dogs that people can get. And Dr. Heidi has been awesome.
Oh, Katie, thank you so much. Well, Dr. Heidi, I don't know. That's a pretty nice response there.
Very nice. Thank you, Katie, so much for your support and kind words. Breeding is a big group of, a population that we do see as cardiologists, where there are breeding animals out there, both dogs and cats, where there's a lot, as I had talked about before, there's a lot of congenital abnormalities that dogs can pass on to their litter, to their offspring. And so a lot of very good responsible breeders will have a cardiologist look at their dogs or listen to them or do echocardiograms, which is the ultrasound of the heart, so that we are having better breeding programs that don't perpetuate a lot of these congenital abnormalities. So breeding and heart health is a very important aspect of making happy, healthy animals.
Is that part of your research program for you, or just something that you kind of got involved with?
Yeah, kind of got involved with. The Whippets started off with a research program, a project that we were working on for a longitudinal study going on for 20 years now, where we've been looking at these Whippets' hearts at their specialty clinic every year, wherever it is in the United States, and doing echocardiograms and screening on their hearts. And we've been able to change over this last 20 years. We've been able to understand more of what the cardiac condition is in Whippet dogs, but also when to say, this disease is presenting too early, maybe you shouldn't breed this dog. Most of these Whippets will have some sort of abnormalities to their valve leaflets by 7 years of age. And so, to keep them in the breeding pool so that you keep diversity and things like that, we're able to help make some of those recommendations and work with these breeders to get the best breeding program that they can.
Yeah. Katie, thanks again for calling. Kenneth in Beloit, we'll go to you. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I'd like to bring up the issue about treating life-threatening diseases in animals, in that my thinking is that animals feel this threat to their lives, and they constantly live in a survival mode. And they suffer many times beyond what we do as human beings.
So, Kenneth, you're really breaking up. But I think we've got Kenneth's talking about the ethics of treating animals when they have disease, and wondering does this multiply the suffering? I think.
Yeah, great question, Kenneth. Absolutely, our primary goal as veterinarians is first, do no harm. But we want to give our patients the best quality of life possible. And so, yes, a lot of these animals have a terminal disease, something that we're not going to be able to fix. But what we are able to do is to take a patient who is ill, in particular patients who can't breathe well, and give them medical therapy most of the time that helps them remove fluid from their lungs, helps get rid of all of these bad abnormal clinical signs that they have and make them feel like dogs again, dogs and cats. So our goal is to make them feel like there's nothing wrong with them. And so that's what our primary responsibility is to give them good quality of life. And we definitely, we're very honest with our clients and our pets' people to be an advocate for them and a voice for them to tell them when we do think that potentially the time has come when medical or surgical treatments are exhausted. And so we're always advocating for our patient, but our goal is to have them have the best quality of life and not be suffering.
Yeah. Kenna, thank you so much. Good question. Appreciate your call. Dr. Heidi Callahan, our guest today, she is head of cardiology for the Department of Medical Science at UW School of Veterinary Medicine as we talk cardio issues with cats and dogs. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking today with Dr. Heidi Callahan. Dr. Heidi is a clinical professor as well as section head of cardiology at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking with her about cardio issues in cats and dogs. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. When is it time to take your dog or cat to the vet?
So when to take your dog to the vet and your cat. So preventative care is monumental in our patients. So yearly exams with your primary care veterinarian will allow your dog or your cat or your pet to have a nice thorough yearly exam. That's often when dogs will be heartworm tested, in particular in this area. We do have heartworm disease, so that's something that you want to screen for on a yearly basis so that we can stay on top of it and get prescribed preventative heartworm medication so that heartworm disease doesn't happen in your pet. And so a yearly exam is very helpful for preventative care and for detecting certain things like murmurs or if your dog is falling over, certain things like that, the primary care veterinarian can help direct where that might need a referral.
Yeah. What kinds of tests do you run to diagnose an animal, a cat or a dog with heart disease?
So with heart disease, the typical scenario is, you know, the heart is something that we can listen to, so we can hear abnormal heart sounds. So if a stethoscope is usually our first step so that we can listen to the heart sounds, we can listen to the lung sounds. And then to look at the inside of the heart, which is often necessary, we do what's called an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of the heart, which allows us to look at the four different chambers, the four different valve leaflets, to see how well the contractility is, to see how, if there's any congenital abnormalities, if there's any holes or anything that's abnormal. And then often with that goes a chest x-ray. So we can see what's going on the inside of the heart, but then the lungs and the rest of the body outside of the heart is often affected by the heart. So we need to see that with x-rays. So a workup often consists of an echocardiogram, chest x-rays. If there's an irregular heart rhythm, then we'll do an electrocardiogram or an EKG, looking at the electricity of the heart. So that's the typical cardiac workup.
Is that a difficult thing I'm thinking about echocardiogram or some of those where, you know, the dog's got to be still, or
yep.
I'm wondering about that.
Yeah, so keeping them still, ideally, yes. But we deal with patients who are panting, who are a little anxious to be there, who are moving. The majority of them do great. We have a table that's on a hydraulic table, so we're able to lift them up easily. We put Great Danes on these tables, Chihuahuas, small cats, and we're basically able to have them lay there. They're gently restrained. We will sedate them if it makes them more compliant or takes the stress off of them, but they just kind of lay there, and we do this ultrasound while they're laying on a table. We're comforting them, we're talking to them, petting them. So sometimes they need a little bit of sedation, but a lot of times they're extremely cooperative just laying there for us.
And I'm wondering, I want to talk about treatments, but I'm also wondering, and before I forget it, I want to bring it up. are there things that we do that can create the condition in the animals? And I'm just, you know, just thinking about my, you know, if I've got a dog or I've got a cat, what can I do? Seems pretty healthy now. What can I do to keep that healthy animal healthy?
Yep. No, great question. So a lot of the congenital abnormalities or the acquired abnormalities, like the valve disease that we see in dogs, is not preventable. So right. You're not going to stop it from happening, but we can slow the progression of some of these diseases. But I think as a day-to-day good rule of thumb is a good diet is a very important part of heart health in our patients. And in particular, we know more research on the dog front than on the cat front. But I'm sure a lot of our audience is aware of the dietary concerns that have come up in the last several years about feeding certain diets to dogs and not feeding certain diets to dogs. And so that is a very important, relatively newish concept that I think we need to deal with and owners need to deal with their pets.
And the best diet?
So we don't recommend a specific diet. There's a lot of controversy sure. as to, you know, which kind of commercial diets are the best. But what we do say is it typically the catchwords are grain free. So in the last few years, you know, there were a lot of grain free diets. And we thought that might actually be a problem in our patients because they were getting a lot of heart disease. A lot of dogs who weren't typical for heart disease were popping up with heart disease. And so we started looking into their diets and realized that a lot of times what was replaced with the grains was actually what we think is the problem. So a lot of the legumes, a lot of the pea products, the pea proteins, the chickpeas, some sweet potatoes, but mainly the legumes are what we think is actually probably a toxic component to their diet that is causing them to have significant cardiac disease enough that it can kill a dog. So it's something wow. that you want to be aware of to be feeding them the correct diet for a long period of time because the incorrect diet can be fatal.
Boy. Let's talk about the treatments. I understand one of your clinical interests is in pacemakers.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us more about that.
So we do a lot of procedures, a lot of interventional procedures in our patients, mainly dogs. But pacemakers are one of those procedures. So many dogs will come in and they'll be falling over or having fainting episodes because their heart rate gets too slow. And that can happen a lot of times with aging dogs. And so the only therapy for some dogs who have a really slow heart rate is to put a pacemaker in. And so we do that in our cardiac catheter lab where they get anesthetized and we basically, with our imaging equipment, we can see kind of the inside of the heart and where we want to place this. But we basically, just the same as human pacemakers, we put a lead into their heart that takes over the heartbeat and then they can live a long and fruitful life. And actually, one of the biggest complaints, because we typically will see these patients back 2 months after they've had the pacemaker placed, and one of the biggest complaints is that people are like, can you lower the battery because my dog's acting like a puppy, jumping on the counter, driving me crazy. And so a lot of times when people just thought their dogs were getting older and slowing down, once they started having episodes of fainting, then they realize that this is something that we can fix. And when it is fixed, they feel brand new.
Well, that's one. Are there other treatments for heart conditions that you have?
Absolutely. So a lot of our heart conditions are medical therapy alone. So most of our therapy for especially acquired adult onset disease is medical management. We treat that with water pills, with Lasix, with different medications that help relieve the symptoms. But there are several mainly congenital abnormalities, conditions that dogs and cats are born with that we will fix in our cardiac catheterization laboratory, which we have a brand new cardiac cath lab here in our new building, in our new space, which is state of the art. It's brand new, human grade, you know, state-of-the-art equipment that allows us to do a lot of these interventional procedures where they're minimally invasive. We go in just into vessels instead of having to open up the thorax and doing things like open heart surgery. You can access a lot of the heart and the vessels through just a catheter-based procedure. And so we can close some certain holes. We can close extra vessels. There's things called patent ductus arteriosus, or PDAs, which is an extra vessel that dogs are born with that we can close non-invasively.
Wow.
With a device. And it basically, we go through the vessels, deploy this device, it causes a clot and stops that abnormal blood flow. And other procedures that we can do, we see a lot of what's called pulmonic stenosis, and that's a narrowing of one of the valves, one of the heart valves. And with that narrowing, it's like putting your finger over the end of the hose. It causes the blood to shoot through a lot faster, and it causes the heart to do a lot more work. And so what we can do is put through a series of catheters, we can put a balloon across that pulmonic valve and basically blow that balloon up and open up that valve so that the dog then doesn't have it, the dog's heart doesn't have to work as hard. And so there's many procedures that are up and coming that we can do here. Typically, the PDAs, where they have an extra small vessel, we could only do in dogs at a certain size because we didn't have the instrumentation for the smaller size. But now we can do closure of these vessels with really small dogs because we have different equipment. So there's a lot of non-invasive interventional procedures that we can do at the university to help alleviate congenital heart disease.
Barb and Oshkosh, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I do. I have a 9-year-old terrier mix who, for the last 2 years, my vet has been telling me that he has a heart murmur.
Okay.
And the last time I brought him in for a checkup, they said it's gone. I'm just wondering how that happens.
Yeah, so it can happen. We all have different ears. And, you know, I was trained in a residency program to have fine-tuned ears, and that's what I do every single day. So depending on who's listening the dog, someone might hear something different. But there are different scenarios. If the dog is dehydrated or if they're sick, if they were anemic, then they can develop a murmur. So there's different things that can cause a murmur that can make it go away. In dogs, that's less typical. Typically, if we hear a murmur, it's because of leaky valves from degenerative changes. But definitely in cats, it's extremely common to have one person hear a murmur, another person not hear a murmur, because cats, as I said before, don't read any real books in the literature. They make up their own stories. And so cats, a lot of cats with heart disease won't have murmurs. A lot of cats with murmurs won't have heart disease. So they're really a mixed bag. But in dogs, in typical, depending on who's listening, some people may hear one thing versus another.
Diane had emailed, and her dog went from a heart murmur at stage 1 to he's now 7.
Yeah.
Wondering what percentage of dogs with a level 1 never have the murmur advance past level 1.
Yeah, it depends on the cause of the murmur again. So if it's an adult dog who has degenerative changes, most likely that murmur is going to get louder. So the murmur indicates the amount of abnormality typically that's present, the amount of leakiness. So in a dog with adult onset disease, like a leaky valve, the murmur intensity will increase, indicating that the disease is progressing. In animals, cats and dogs who have murmurs that they were born with, a lot of times they just stay where they are and they don't necessarily progress. Mm-hmm. But the acquired diseases, adult onset diseases, usually as they progress, the disease is progressing, the murmur progresses. Congenital heart disease, often the murmur will stay where it is because they were born with it.
And on that note, boy, this flew by. I hope you can come back and be with us again down the road, Dr. Heidi. Appreciate it very much. Dr. Heidi Callahan, clinical professor and section head of cardiology for the Department of Medical Sciences at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. They're doing a lot of great work. And the team at the Larry Mueller Show does a lot of great work as well. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, executive producer, Jill Nadeau. And I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.